times of introspection and self-analysis. There are many subjects we could consider, and I'm sure that we've picked some of our own during this past week. I'd like you, please, just listen carefully as I read some of these sentences using the word accusation. The police arrested him based on the accusation of theft. Her false accusation ruined his reputation. He vehemently denied the accusation of him cheating on the test. The accusation of bribery led to a full investigation. His friend's accusation left him feeling betrayed. The accusation cast doubt on his integrity. She was tired of constantly facing false accusations, so she left. The court will carefully examine the accusation before a decision is made. And the last one, the accusation haunted him for the rest of his life. Please come with me to Revelation 12, where a common scripture says this. Revelation 12, verses 10 and 11. It says in verse 10, "And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now has come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of the brethren is cast down, which accused them, us, before our God day and night, all day long." Accusations. It's hard to even imagine that, because it's hard to be in a defensive position when you're being accused of something nonstop. So our SBS today, brethren, is let us learn together the anatomy of an accusation. The anatomy of an accusation. We'll ask a few questions. What is an accusation? Where does an accusation originate? Does the intent of the accusation make it lethal? How do we live on both sides of an accusation? So number one, what is an accusation? Defined, if you look it up, it says it's a statement or claim that someone has done something wrong, illegal, or immorally questionable. Something wrong, illegal, or immorally questionable. All these circumstances require a certain discernment of facts before it is brought out. But this particular definition sets us up with an understanding about kind of what an accusation is. We might find ourselves on one side of a coin or the other, either the accuser or the accused. So an accusation is a statement or claim that someone has done something wrong, illegal, or immorally questionable. Question number two. Where does an accusation originate? Where does an accusation originate? It begins with a tempting thought. A tempting thought. An invitation to test a person's faith, their obedience, or their moral integrity. It starts with a simple thought. Come with me to James 1. James 1, verses 12 through 16. Verse 12, I find it interesting that it says, "Blessed is the man that endures temptation," because you never feel blessed when you're enduring a temptation, but this is what it says, and I'll explain that a little better in a minute. "For when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to them that love him. So let no man say when he's tempted, I'm tempted of God." So it sets a framework. No temptations come for God cannot be tempted with evil, so he doesn't use it to tempt any man, which he leaves the field open then to Satan and his cohorts. Verse 14, "But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust." Person owns something that the temptations hook to and entices that person. Verse 15, "And when that lust has conceived, it brings forth sin. And then sin, when it is finished, brings forth death. So you can see that it starts with a temptation and a certain nurturing of the thought. But you look in verse 2 of the same chapter, yet we're told, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into these various temptations. Because they become a temptation when it enters your mind, and now you realize, aha, this is something I have to deal with. But if you look at 2 Corinthians, come there with me, please. 2 Corinthians. In chapter 10. God helps us to see a little bit how our brains work when it comes to decision making and what we do. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 2. It says, but I beseech you, we generally use the word beg. We don't use beseech other than in Mary Poppins, I heard it the other day. But I beseech you that I may not be bold when I am present with that confidence, wherewith I think it to be bold against some. Okay, now look what he says. Some which think of us as if we walked according to the flesh. Someone has made a decision in their brain that Paul walks according to the flesh. And we might just go right by it because it's not us. It's Paul, right? But this has been happening for a very long time. It is in the context of this that Paul brings it up that he says, verse 5, cast down imaginations. A better term for imaginations isn't like imagination in your mind. You're thinking of, you know, unicorns and cotton candy. It's more along the line of speculative reasoning. Speculative reasoning. They did this because of that. I saw them do that, so therefore. As if we're sitting in a judgment position of whatever that is. That's why it's called speculative reasoning. So casting down, Paul says, as he's coming from a position of someone doing that to him, casting down speculative reasoning and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. So we find a little check mark next to it saying, is this something that God would think is holy, good, and right? Continuing 5. And then he tells them, Corinthians, bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. So when this occurs, then you find less accusations. You find less of this speculative reasoning. Verse 6, and having in a readiness to revenge all disobedience. That's an interesting use of the word revenge, which really means punish. All disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. There's another way of saying it. It's just obey God's laws. We're told all the time, love your neighbors yourself and all those kinds of things. But this one here is relational. Probably the most important part of our character is relational. It says, do you look on things after the outward appearance? Why does he say that? Because the outward appearance doesn't tell you about the inward heart, i.e. think of David. You know, think of others that were called when they were young, Samuel, others as well. If any man trust to himself that he is Christ, let him of himself think this again, that as he is Christ, even so are we Christ. So when we claim this identification, this part of the family, he's telling us how we should think, how we should actually channel our thoughts, harness our thoughts. And I'll make it more clear as we go through here with some examples. Verse 12, for we dare not make ourselves of the number or compare ourselves with some that commend themselves. He gives us another possible mind field here to start comparing yourself with someone else. What you have and they don't have, what you used to have and not have. I was just speaking with someone the other day where they were from, born in Lebanon, and when Lebanon got converted over to a more Islamic held country, they bombed her house, and she was bombed in the wreckage and was in the hospital for 2.5 months, made her dad permanently deaf, who died a few months later, and then her mom died after that. Then she lived in a bomb shelter for 4 years, and then came over here. All right, and her perspective on relational Christianity, which she calls herself a Christian and seems to act like one too, is one not to care about what they have or don't have. She said, because we went from having some of the finest restaurants in Lebanon to having nothing because her dad sold everything that belonged to the business, turned it into money the day before they bombed the house. And when they bombed the house, it started on fire and everything he had went up with the fire. So the very next week, they were completely poor, living in a bomb shelter, trying to stay away from being killed. Pretty amazing story, right? So I guarantee you, absolutely guarantee you on my well-being, that they were not comparing themselves one with another, because their framework, their thinking was not of that kind. And it tells you here at the end of verse 12, it's not wise to do it anyway. In John, 3 John, the letters, you know, I love this guy, John. He has a lot to say, but let's go to his letters, not the gospel. 3 John, only one chapter there, verses 9 through 11. Notice the determination to see good here. I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, receives us not. The disposition of Diotrephes is not the disposition we wish to act like. Wherefore, verse 10, if I come, I will remember his deeds, which he did, prating against us with malicious words, not content therewith. Okay, that's another way of saying with prating against us with malicious words of accusations. Not content within themselves, you know, for some reason there's a disruption, like a storm within the person, and they have to do this. Neither did he himself receive the brethren, didn't have that sense of love and outgoing concern, and forbids them that would, and casts them out of the church. This is just living in an environment of accusation, is what John's saying, which is not good. Because in verse 11, John says, after that, beloved, you know, you brethren, follow that not which is evil, but that which is good. He that does good is of God, but he that does evil has not seen God. So this concept of accusation originates with our thoughts. And we're told to capture them. And we're told to frame them up in the Word of God. And we're told to lead the bad ones away. And we're told to obey the good ones. That's the framework. Seems easy, but we all know it's harder than it sounds. So the third question, does the intent of the accusation make it lethal? Does the intent of the accusation make it lethal? Come with me to the book of Matthew, chapter 11, verses 18 and 19. Matthew 11, verses 18 and 19. Because here are some, you know, a little bit of examples of how things happen with having a mindset that doesn't put in checkmate the accusational part of our brain. Matthew 11, verse 18. For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say, he has a devil. Why? Because he wasn't eating or drinking? Pretty big accusation. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, behold, a man gluttonous. Wow, kind of flipping it around now, aren't we? Now, this guy's gluttonous, Jesus Christ, gluttonous, a wine bibber, a friend of publicans and sinners. And wisdom is justified of her children, it says. And these are the words of Jesus Christ here, showing the accusations one way versus the other. In John 5, let's go there, John 5, the gospel, verse 18. Verse 18, therefore, the Jews sought the more to kill him, because he not only had broken the Sabbath, according to them, but said also that God was his father, making himself equal with God, as if they knew. Accusations born in facts that they didn't have any real connection to, but yet the accusations were made. Luke 23. Come there with me, please. Luke 23. Verses 1 and 2. And this is an interesting example here, verse 1, because now you have a whole multitude that is also participating in the accusation. And the whole multitude of them arose and led him, Jesus, to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ a king." Stiff accusations against Jesus Christ, as we know, gave his life for us. How about Mark 3? Let's go there. There's a number of these types of areas in the scriptures. I'm just giving some examples about how an accusation works and does it make it lethal. Mark 3, verse 2. "And they watched him, whether he would heal him on the Sabbath day, that they might accuse him." Their disposition of heart was to watch somebody so that they could accuse them. I don't think they were capturing in their brain the thoughts the way God says we should capture them. They weren't arresting those thoughts. They were feeding them. Luke 11. Come there with me, please. Luke 11. This concept will hook on to almost every sin, what we call leavening, that we're involved with. Because if you're to forestall it at the thought level and size it up and obey, you wouldn't get to the leavening level. Luke 11, verse 54. "Laying wait for him and seeking to catch something out of his mouth that they might accuse him." Pretty heavy intent, pretty heavy intent. So accusations are complaints that are issued with purpose. They were doing this because they had purpose. There was intent, and they were trying, like you would go fishing, setting the net, setting the hook, trying to catch this. Recount the process. A judgment or opinion is formed. This leads to an accusation. This develops the forcing of a decision, because the accusation then pushes you into the decision stage. The decision is established based on the truth and or a lie. And then the verdict or the reputation is declared and accepted. How about if we think about it this way? What is the character of the plaintiff? The person complaining. What is that person? What's their character? If their character's good, then probably what they have to say has merit. Matthew 21. Come there with me. Matthew 21. Verses 45 and 46. And of course, that also works the other direction if the character is not good. Matthew 21, verse 45 and 46. "And when the chief priests and the Pharisees had heard his parables, they perceived that he spoke of them. But when they sought to lay hands on him," obviously they didn't like what he had to say, it was cutting to their hearts, "they feared the multitude because they took him for a prophet." So they backed off because they were worried for their own skin, so to speak. In Matthew 26, verse 59. Matthew 26, verse 59. Now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death. When we see things like this, we tend to set the life of Jesus and what happened to him over there. And we're observers. And we're watching and going, that was terrible. Would I have ever done that? Would I? Because when you start to bring it into your own life and you think, oh, how good we are as people, we're excusing the fact that our brain works just like every other human being that's been born. We're excusing the fact that we don't think Satan can stick something in your brain. Or we might think since we have God's Holy Spirit, it doesn't work that way. We excuse ourselves another way. But the fact is, Paul is talking to people later on here in Corinthians who have God's Holy Spirit, who are still faced with it. And we're reading examples of what people did with this and this kind of thinking. Remember the story of Pharaoh and Israel? Of course you do. Let's go through the four-point process. Remember, a judgment or opinions form leading to an accusation. Okay? Let's go through that one first. Let's go to Exodus 1. Come there with me, please. Exodus 1. A judgment or opinion is formed leading to an accusation. Exodus 1, verse 7. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. You might say God's hand was blessing them. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. Remember, Joseph brought them back in because of the drought. And then after that, they stayed there. And when they stayed there, they grew great. And they had favor because Joseph was in his position. A new king took over. With the new king, they didn't have this benefit. That's how quickly things can change in an individual's life. Verse 9, and he said to his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. He made a judgment. These people are stronger than we. Uh-oh. He did exactly what Paul points out. He took that thought and he didn't channel it righteously. That accusation then develops, forcing a decision. Verse 10. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply and it come to pass that when there falls out any war, they join the enemies, fight against us. So get them up out of the land. So the little accusation now forms into a decision that impacts all of them. That decision is established. Verse 11. Therefore, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses. Now you realize, or we should realize, in a matter of five scriptures, we went from favor and multiplying and waxing exceedingly mighty to becoming slaves. All of Israel became slaves based on an accusational thought that they might join someone and go against us. And then this verdict that he makes becomes accepted in what we know in verses 12 through 14. But the more they afflicted them, and the more they grew and multiplied, and they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor, with harshness. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them to serve was with rigor. They were forced into a disposition because an accusation, a false one, was made on the whole house of Israel. And it happened fast. Which makes me think that there should be a sermon at some point about the prophecy, about the taking over of this country and how quickly that could happen. But we'll save that for another time. Let us recount now another story. Come with me, please, to the book of Esther. Same four processes. A judgment or opinion is formed, leading to an accusation. Esther 3, verse 1. Esther 3, verse 1. After these things, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and revered Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did he him any reverence. Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said to Mordecai, "Why transgress you the king's commandment?" And now it came to pass, when they spoke daily to him, and he hearkened not to them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand. For he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. So you find this guy here forms an opinion. He's a Jew, and he's not doing what I want him to do. So now we're going to have to take action and make something happen. Verse 6. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai, wherefore Haman sought to destroy, look at this, all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. All because one person did something he didn't like. He accused them of something, found out he was a Jew, included everybody, and threw everybody under the bus at the same time. Exact same thinking process we've been following since we examined Corinthians and Paul's instruction. These people were doing it, and they were high authority, and they did it because of it. So in the first month, that is the month of Nisan, verse 7, 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot, before Haman that day to day, and from month to month, and the 12th month, that is the month of Adar. And Haman said to King Ahasuerus, okay, now he starts to trump it up a little bit. He starts to get some ideas on what he's going to do with this. You know, King, there's a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom, and their laws are different from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws, therefore it is not the king's profit to allow them. So if it please the king, he's leading the king along with his accusation, let it be written that they may be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries. Trumping it up to make it happen. Chapter 5, verse 14. Chapter 5, verse 14. Then said Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends to him, "Let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high, and tomorrow speak you to the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. Then go you in merrily with the king to the banquet." And the thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. All because someone didn't give him what he wanted. Brought it all the way that far. Trumps it up. Accuses him. But Almighty God was watching. Let's go back to Esther 2. Esther 2, verse 21. Esther 2, verse 21. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were angry and sought to lay hand on King Ahasuerus. Verse 22. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it to Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. Verse 23. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore, they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of Chronicles before the king. And time goes on, and that is forgotten. Until you start seeing this story of Haman develop. Let's go to Esther 6. And God starts to chime in. Esther 6, verse 1. On that night could not the king sleep, and he commanded to bring the book of records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. Have you ever had it where you have a restless night? He's like, I just can't sleep. You get up, pick something up, and maybe read it or whatever, and go back to bed. That's kind of what's happening here. He was kind of stirred, got up. He's prompted to read this book of records of the Chronicles. And then his eyes fall on this. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains, the keepers of the door, who sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus, who is, by the way, Persian, which would be Iranian today. You know, all the stuff going on in Iran. This guy was Iranian. Verse 3, and the king said, what honor and dignity has been done to Mordecai for this? Then said the king's servants that ministered to him, there's nothing done for him. And his brain starts to spin now, starts to wonder, what shall we do? Now remember the verdict of Haman, and what was expected was an outcome to hang the Jews, starting with Mordecai. But then you have this dream of Almighty God implanting it on behalf of his people, these things. Verse 4. And the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman was coming to the outward court of the king's house to speak to the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's servant said to him, behold, Haman stands in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought in his heart, to whom would the king delight to do honor more than to myself? Days of unleavened bread, pride, pride, pride. Not humility, leavened attitude. Can't see straight, it's so bad. Verse 7, and Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let the royal apparel be brought, which the king uses to wear, and the horse that the king rides upon, and the crown royal, which is set upon his head. And let his apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man with whom the king delights to honor, and bring him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And I could just see Haman's chest puffing up. His head's almost glowing. He's so waiting for this to happen. Then the king said to Haman, make haste, take the apparel and the horse, as you have said, and do even to Mordecai the Jew. Can you imagine the look? God orchestrated the whole thing. But let's recount. When the hook was put in Mordecai's head that these guys were trying to injure the king, basically kill him, he did the right thing. When we make decisions and we know things aren't right, do we do the right thing? Do we look at the hook and say, I'm doing the right thing. I don't care. I may have to go to the gallows, and I don't know why God's letting this happen, but I'm doing the right thing. I'm going to obey God's law because it's God's law, not because I'm a legalist. It's because I love God. I'm going to do what God wants me to do. And I'm going to do it in a humble attitude. And that's all there is to it. It's a disposition of your mind that puts you in a place where God can work with you. Esther 6, I'm sorry, 7, verse 3. Esther 7, verse 3. Then Esther the queen answered and said, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my position and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. But if we had been sold to bondmen and bondwomen, I had kept my tongue." In other words, I would allow this to be gone into slavery, but this is more than that. This is just complete annihilation, genocide. Although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage. And then King Ahasuerus answered and said to Esther the queen, "Who is he? Where is he? That dare presume in his heart to do so?" Because the king hadn't realized that when he was talking to Haman and what he was doing and how Mordecai would be recipient of this going through the streets on his horse, he had no idea that that's who we were talking about. So the king's listening to Esther intently. And Esther said, verse 8, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen. The king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden. Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. Then the king returned out of the palace garden into the palace banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen and stumbling upon the bed wherein Esther was. A complete disrespectful thing to do, not in a sexual sense, but looked bad. Then said the king, "Will he force the queen also before me in my house?" Because his mind now was Haman was wicked. And the word went out from the king's mouth. They covered Haman's face, which is what they do still today in that part of the world. They cover your face when they take you away. And Harbonah, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, "Behold, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who had spoken good for the king, stands in the house of Haman." Then the king said, "Hang him thereon." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. Accusations can be lethal. One more story, and it is more than fitting that we do this one. Come with me, please, to John. Well, we will chronicle in the same manner what happened to Jesus Christ. Chapter 5, verse 8. Chapter 5, verse 8 of John. Jesus had healed a man, and then he said, "Rise, take up your bed and walk." And immediately the man was made whole, took up his bed, and walked. On the same day was the Sabbath. And the Jews therefore said to him that was cured, "It's the Sabbath day. It's not lawful for you to carry your bed." And he answered them, "He that made me whole, the same said to me, take up your bed and walk." We can get into a discussion about whether this man was even a Jew or whether it should even the law should even pertain to him. But what they did is they extended what he told this man, and they tried to make him guilty of working on the Sabbath because they're aiming to injure Christ. Verse 15, the man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus which had made him whole. Therefore did the Jews persecute Jesus and sought to slay him because he had done some of these things on the Sabbath day. They were looking for a reason. So the accusation here is that he's not keeping the law of God. This develops into a decision. Verse 18, therefore the Jews sought the more to kill him because he not only had broken the Sabbath, but said also that God was his father, making himself equal with God. They start to trump it up more. In Matthew 26, let's go there. Matthew 26. 59 and 60, verses 59 and 60. Now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death. Hard to imagine. The chief priests, the elders, and all the council, none of them had the presence of mind to say, we're charging this guy with something he didn't do. He's not guilty. But they wanted him out of their hair. They've known this boy, now man, since he was 13. And they were building up evidence against him this whole time. More and more. Every year. Every year. So they seek, it says here, false witness. Verse 60. But found none. Yea, though many false witnesses came, yet found they none. But at the last came two false witnesses. Okay, we'll take those. So the decision's established. Let's go to the next part of this, verse 66. Once they believe they have him guilty of blasphemy and breaking the Sabbath, they said, well, what should we do with him? He's guilty of death. Let's kill the guy that didn't do what we claim he does. Luke 22, verse 65. Luke 22, verse 65. Same process. An accusation's made. It's issued with a purpose. The accusation develops into forcing a decision. The decision now is based on truth or lies. In this case, lies. And it ends up with a judgment. Luke 22, verse 65. No different than the Pharaoh, no different than Mordecai. And a whole host of other examples in the scriptures. 22, verse 65. And many other things blasphemously, wickedly, spoke they against him. Their heart was wrong. Their heart was wicked. Their heart had vile ideas and thoughts in it. But God the Father counted on the power of Satan and this to happen. He actually counted on it. He knew that this was going to happen way before anybody else knew. Verse 63. And the men that held Jesus mocked him and smote him. And when they had blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, prophesy, who is it that smote you? You know, real snarky, mean, wicked, unloving attitude. Verse 20, chapter 23, verse 20. Chapter 23, verse 20. Pilate, therefore, willing to release Jesus, spoke again to them. Because he was seeing, you know, what they're saying is not really worthy of what they're talking about here. But they cried, saying, crucify him. They cried, saying it, a group that was agitated to say things in accusational style when they didn't know what they were doing. They just were repeating what they were told. And he said to them the third time, what evil has he done? I found no cause of death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go. And they were instant, insistent with a loud voice, requiring that he might be crucified. You could almost hear it in the background in the courtyard. Crucify him! Crucify him! Hands up! Crucify him! And the voices of them and chief priests prevailed. And the Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they required. One of the saddest days. He released them, him that for sedition and murder was cast into prison, whom they had desired, but delivered Jesus to their will. The criminals were released, and the non-criminal was not. Verse 33. And when they were come to the place, which is called Calvary, there they crucified him. And the malefactors on one hand, and the other on the left. Then said Jesus, And when anybody ever says that they believe in the Trinity, I tell them, just read this scripture here, because if they were the same being, it was a charade. Because the Jesus and Father are separate. Then said Jesus, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. The most vile of accusations, costing him his life. Of course, God had purpose in it. And of course, then what happens is verse 46, Jesus cries with a loud voice and says, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. The intent of the accuser is what makes the accusation lethal. So what does the Bible say about one's right? Point four, how do we live on both sides of the accusation today? What does the Bible say about one's right when it comes to accusations and accuser? Let's go to Deuteronomy, because it is, certainly does tell us. Deuteronomy 19. Deuteronomy 19, verses 15 through 20. Verse 15. One witness shall not rise up against a man for any sin, or for any sin, iniquity or sin, if any sin that he sins, at the mouth of two witnesses, or at the mouth of three witnesses, shall the matter be established. If a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges, which shall be in those days. And the judges shall make diligent inquisition, and behold, if the witness be a false witness and has testified falsely against his brother, then shall you do to him as he had thought to have done to his brother. So shall you put the evil away from among you. This is essentially what happened with Mordecai and Haman. If you reverse engineer the process, that when you first have the thought, the little hook, the little troubling thought about someone or something, and you throw it forward and engineer it all the way to the end, and you have some belief that what you could be thinking isn't accurate, I really don't know, I wasn't there, wouldn't it be better just to leave it alone rather than to possibly suffer the consequences of this? In Acts 25, years later, after we have the book of Deuteronomy, in Acts 25, this concept works its way right into Roman law, just as it does into the U.S. legal system today. Acts 25, verses 14 through 16. Verse 14. And when they had been there many days, Festus declared Paul's cause to the king, saying, there's a certain man left in bonds by Felix, who was the previous ruler. Verse 15. About whom, when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me, desiring to have judgment against him. They had a problem. They wanted to get Paul, their problem, out of their hair. Verse 16. To whom I answered, it is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die before that he which is accused have the accusers face to face, and have license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against him. When you consider somebody saying, can you tell so-and-so that, whatever it is, whenever it's a problem, the law says you shall state, face yourself with that problem accuser. Face to face, you shall work out that problem, face to face. And if a problem becomes more than that, then steps it up. I'm not going to a Matthew 18 thing. I'm just showing and pointing out that this is the kind of thing that keeps us out of trouble relationally. We've been going through all these examples, relational difficulties, all of them. John 7, let's go there. It talks a little bit about Nicodemus. I mean, you remember Nicodemus, right? And he goes to Jesus at night. And one of the things that he says in response to some of the Pharisees and others commenting about Jesus and the Christians, he maintains this concept. Verse 51 of John 7, Nicodemus says to them, "He that came to Jesus by night," being one of them, "does our law judge any man before it hear him and know what he does?" That's what accusations do. Accusations judge you all the way down. It might be on a small level. It might not end up in the court over here downtown, but it ends up in your families, your neighborhoods, your friendships. I read all of the different ones. The accusation waged against him or her ruined their relationship, etc., etc. Why not back up and think about some of those things and restore? Why not restore rather than continue? You know, in Proverbs 30, as a perspective, Proverbs 30, Proverbs 30, verse 10, you know, in the book of wisdom here, "Accuse not a servant to his master, lest he curse you and you be found guilty." It's like, why would you do it to his master? If you have a problem, just go to him. Go to somebody else. "Oh, I don't feel comfortable doing that." Well, then you shouldn't feel comfortable doing an accusation. It doesn't make any sense. If you don't feel strongly enough about it, and I don't say this correctly. Honestly, I don't. If I have an issue with anybody in here, I'll just go right through you, to you. I'm not really, it doesn't bother me. You know, I might feel bad. I don't want to have an issue with anybody. But you have to follow these things, to have a good heart, to take Passover, to be happy, to be joyful, to have the kind of inside environment that is loving and forgiving and merciful and kind. These are things that we use and build up to be good Christians, to have a group that's cohesive, to be chemically sound as relationships would do. Not many things will be more important than the relationships. But we live in a time which is spoken in 2 Timothy. Remember Timothy, the young guy that, we'll go there, 2 Timothy 3, that Paul kind of nurtured, then puts into the ministry, knowing that he had, you know, a grandma and a mom that were believers. And so he nurtures him, and then he writes him this letter in 2 Timothy while he's in prison. And this letter that he writes are Paul's last thoughts before he's actually killed. So 2 Timothy 3, he says, "What can I tell Timothy before I go?" Verse 1, he says, "Well, know this, that in the last days, dangerous times shall come." You don't think they're dangerous now. Go on YouTube and look up what's happening in London. One area. And I can give you a whole bunch more. When we were over in London, I talked to this taxi cab driver who was Pakistani and a Muslim. And he said, "I don't like it here. The Muslims don't work. They're taking over. They're not citizens, and they're doing what they want." 10,000 female assaults in 1 month. You don't think that we live in perilous times? It's because it's safe here in Zephyr Hills. In Nigeria, they killed 13,000 last week. Because they were Christians. Know this, that in the last days, perilous time shall come. And then he tells us, verse 3, verse 2 has a bunch of qualities, but verse 3, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers. You did this, or you did that. You don't worship Allah. And don't think I'm making this up, please. It's a growing population. Do you know that when President Obama was in office, there was 1.3 billion Muslims? 16 years ago. There's 2 billion today. They've grown 700 million in 16 years. You calculating that number? That's huge growth. And it's strong. Numbers will win. 6 and 7 children per family. I'm not saying to hate them, brethren. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that. But they hate you. They hate Christians. Their song goes like this. They go to church on Saturday, Jews. They go to church on Sunday. We kill them all on Monday. It's a rhyme that they sing. Perilous times shall come. One of those features is false accusers. A false accuser is a liar. The liar. And they make it look like it's truth. John 8, start to wind it down here. John 8. Verses 4 through 12. Verse 4, they say to him, they take this lady to Jesus and say, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. And Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what do you say? This they said, tempting him. Okay, very first thing, remember I told you, the first hook, they were setting the hook. That they might have to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down, didn't say anything, and with his finger wrote on the ground as though he heard them not. And when they continued asking him, he lifted up himself and said to them, He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. And there's all kinds of ideas what he wrote in the ground, which was incriminating, however. We don't know exactly what it was. And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. And they which heard it, being convicted by their own conscience, went out one by one, beginning at the eldest, even to the last. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing in the midst. And Jesus had lifted up himself, saw none but the woman, and he said to her, Woman, where are those your accusers? He's able to remove your accusers. That's the point. He is able to remove your accusers, my accusers. He says, Where are those accusers? Has no man condemned you? Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. Same pattern, but Jesus' involvement. So our perspective should be the same. Most of the time, a lot of times, it's best just to be quiet. Matthew 27. Let's go there. Matthew 27. Verses 11 and 12. And Jesus stood up before the governor, and the governor asked them, saying, Are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus said to him, Well, you say. And when he was accused of the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. Because he had confidence in his Father. That is a good example. That is a good example. And we read earlier in Luke 23 where he says, about to die, to have the control of your emotions and your mind and say, Father, forgive them. For they know not what they do. He's hurting, blood running down his neck, rest of his body. And his response is, forgive them, for they know not what they do. So God gives us the right to face our accuser. He encourages us to make wise, obedient, non-judgmental decisions about others. He encourages us not to live in sin in any way, shape, or form. It may be convenient, but if it's wrong, it's wrong. God's flagship for us is forgiveness and love. And he expects us to live in a way where we show that. Minimize your accusations and speculative reasonings. It does me, you, us, none of us good. Doesn't do us any good. And I believe I'll end with this, that it's best to follow Jesus' example and just let him fight our struggles for us. Let's have a good rest of the Holy Day. My wife and I will be going over to St. Pete's. So I don't have a lot of time after.